And welcome to tonight's program with Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Judge Ladaris Cordell, and it's my pleasure to moderate tonight's conversation, LGBTQ Rights, What's at Stake, in partnership with San Francisco Pride. Our panelists tonight are Matt Haney, Commissioner, San Francisco Unified School Board, Mia Satya, community organizer, social justice advocate, and 2016 San Francisco Pride Grand Marshal, and Rick Welts, President and Chief Operating Officer, the Golden State Warriors. We look forward to hearing each of their unique perspectives on the current state of LGBTQ rights and advocacy amidst legislative, executive, and judicial efforts across the country. So let's get started. So you all, just when LGBTQ folks get used to being second-class citizens, we've just been erased. Now what happened this week. The Census Bureau just announced that the next census in 2020 will not include any questions related to sexual orientation or gender identity. So that means that if the LGBTQ community is not included in the census data, we don't exist when it comes to, for example, funding services for this community. No funding for healthcare, counseling, you name it. And since the census is undertaken every 10 years, we won't exist for a decade. Your reactions? Matt.
I think it's absolutely shameful. I guess Donald Trump said he wants to make America great again, and for that, it means for him to erase what the large majority of this country is, which is diverse, which is LGBT, which is people of color, which is women. And I think that he thinks, and his administration seems to think, that if they pretend that people don't exist, that they can take us back to some other former era. And I think it's, I hope that, and I heard that this happened, and I hope it's not final yet, because this would be a devastating change for our ability to meet our needs as a community, as a school. If we didn't have that information, if we didn't know, as a community, as a city, it's going to affect our ability to serve our citizens.
So Mia, were you shocked? Are you shocked to hear this?
Trans people are used to being a second or third thought and being erased from data streams. And, you know, even when you register for emails, a lot of email providers, social media, you have to pick, are you male, are you female? You can't get an email address if you don't tell us which. And so, you know, I know that it took decades of advocacy for us to have any LGBT-related questions on the census, and it's certainly frustrating to see how quickly, with, you know, the stroke of a pen, those rights and that those data collection streams can be taken away. But we're going to continue to advocate because LGBTQ people have always been here and will continue to be here.
I guess the question is, though, I mean, the census is taken every 10 years, and there's a Census Bureau. And I'm just curious, I don't know the answer to this. You know, who's in charge of that? Is this something that's just a directive that came out of the White House? I don't know, because this was kind of suddenly kind of rolled out. Does anybody have a sense about, you know, what steps could be taken to deal with this if this is now what the census forms are going to look like?
I would have asked the judge.
I bet somebody in this room knows the answer to that question. So,
I'm reminded of a story I'd love to share that during the NBA Finals, in which nothing really good happened after Game 4 last year, but in the midst of the NBA Finals, my partner and I had been invited to the White House to take part in President Obama's Pride celebration. Maybe others were there as well. And it was such a joyous time. You know, there was such an amazing feeling in the room amongst the political people, amongst the guests that were invited there, that the president's speech that day, I think, was quite remarkable. And I've reflected back on it a lot, because as much as he was recounting and embracing what had happened over the 8 years of his administration and all the progress that had been made, his real message was, any of you who think this is over, it's not over. okay? This can get reversed as quickly as it happened. And, you know, anyone who thinks this is some irreversible march is wrong, that we need to continue to be vigilant. And things that have been won may have to be won again. And I think that, you know, things like this, you know, bring that back in terms of, you know, this is not over. And this is something that we're going to be dealing with who knows for how long.
I mean, this discussion is about what's at stake, and the census is huge. That's a really big deal. So hopefully now that more people know about it, some steps can be taken, be it lawsuits, whatever it may take to get that changed. So, Rick, you were talking about the feeling in the White House when Obama was there. So let's talk about the feeling in the White House now, all right? And specifically, the big four, I call them the gang of four. So you've got Trump, Pence, Sessions, and Bannon. And I want us to not so much, you know, sit up here and berate them if you don't like them, but my question is more about who's driving the train when it comes to LGBTQ issues and rights. Who in the administration do you think is calling the shots? Is it, you know, one particular person? Is it some combination? And the second question I want to pose to you all, I mean, it all sounds pretty horrifying. I mean, when you look at the fact that Pence, when he was the governor of Indiana, and we're talking 2015, he signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and that law allows businesses within the state of Indiana to discriminate against members of the LGBTQ community based on their personal religious beliefs, and that's the law in Indiana. You've got Trump, who has been some characterized as a waffler-in-chief on LGBTQ issues. You've got Sessions, who really pushed Trump to rescind the guidelines that were that Obama had put out regarding bathroom usage in schools. And then you have Steve Bannon, often dubbed as the Trump whisperer. When he ran Breitbart, just a couple of headlines from from Breitbart: "Gay rights have made us dumber. It's time to get back in the closet." That was a headline. Another: "I've worked it out. ISIS is a gay death cult." So, given the four, what's your sense, one, about who's running the show there? And my second question is this: is there anybody in the current administration or outside who can or will put the brakes on these guys? I mean, Ivanka, Jared, Democrats. So talk. So let's talk first about who do you think's, you know, really driving the train on this thing?
And you didn't include Vladimir Putin in the big five.
You talk.
Good, I think. Hope he's not driving things.
So who? Go ahead.
I don't know. I feel like, you know, who here watches the news? You know, I feel like every time I turn on the news, I'm confused. I don't know who's in charge. I don't actually know if anybody's in charge. I mean, that's how it seems some days. I think that the four people that you named, all of them, what they have in common is that they got to where they are by turning people on each other. And, you know, if that's the reality and that's what they come together around, that's not good for us. Who's in charge on any given day? I have no idea. Sometimes it feels like Donald Trump would rather play golf than govern the country. And so somebody's got to be governing during that time and making decisions.
But don't you think Pence, I mean, because he's the one, I think he is perhaps the most anti-LGBTQ and anti-female person I think the White House has ever seen. So I don't know, my gut, and again, we don't know for a fact, but my gut says that the president may be leaving those decisions to his vice president. What do you all think?
I think that they're all complicit and they're all guilty in using LGBTQ people, immigrants, refugees as political pawns and blaming them for our country's long problems of racial and economic inequality, and that certainly, you know, if I was voting for one of them who is the most guilty, I would choose Pence because of his nonsense that he started in Indiana, but that really these religious liberty bills, I don't honestly think that each of those four or five people mentioned are anti-LGBT. I think that they know it's a smart move to drum up support from their base, and that they've been guilty in using that. But that the good news, and I love having some sort of good news, is that my generation and younger is overwhelmingly in support of LGBT and specifically trans rights. They get it. They understand it. They're not here for any of this discrimination. And so I really see those five as a dying breed. Trump, Pence, you know, they know that this is their last chance and their last stand to make a homophobic, transphobic country, and they're doing all they can.
So who's going to put the brakes, if anyone, either within that administration or even in Washington? Is there anybody or group?
Right. You know, it's so fascinating to watch the dynamic. Everything in the White House right now is defined as either a win or a loss. It's not about what's right. It's either did we win or did we lose. And the early track record is not good. And it's somebody who does not like to be on the losing end of the equation. So I would not be surprised that I'll see a real shakeup in his inner circle in the not-too-distant future. And, you know, there were chuckles, but I actually think you've named the one person. I'm only connected to through, you know, and other people to one of the people you mentioned, and Ivanka actually is that person who I have, you know, friends who know her, who really feel like she is a moderating influence on her father, and that he listens. And so she just took an official position in the White House, right, as his special assistant. So, you know, I retain hope that that she actually has a voice in her father's ear.
Well, we will see. I know there are issues, of course, of nepotism that have arisen, and we'll see how long that position lasts. But we'll see.
I'm not holding my breath. Maybe you know her better than I do.
What about the Democrats? Do you think there's any people that can jump in there and... Hearing silence, I will move on. I will move on to the next.
It's about all you can say about them, I guess.
All right. I'm hoping that all of us here are still hopeful that things can be made better, and that's why we'll keep talking. I think we'll get there before the evening's out. So, since things that we've talked about so far, I get a feel that they're kind of going down the toilet. We might as well talk about bathroom bills. All right? So let's talk about bathroom bills. And in order to do that, if you don't mind, I want to give just a very quick kind of background to bring us from when it started to where we are now. And then I'm going to ask you, Rick, the latest on all this, because he does have the latest, some kind of breaking news on this. So in February 2016, the Charlotte, North Carolina City Council enacted an ordinance prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity in public accommodations. That's Charlotte. They did a good thing. A month later, March 2016, the North Carolina State Legislature introduced HB 2, House Bill 2, and it took exactly 11 hours, 10 minutes for it to pass the House, the Senate, and be signed by the governor into law. That is a record. So HB 2 regulates bathroom usage around the concept of biological sex, which it defines in North Carolina as, quote, the physical condition of being male or female, which is stated on a person's birth certificate. Now, 2 months later, May 2016, the Obama administration's Justice Department, led by Loretta Lynch, and the Education Department issued, and in Washington they call these Dear Colleague Letters. And it was an 8-page letter that they sent out to all schools in the country, advising them about their obligations under Title IX to provide transgender students access to sex-segregated activities and facilities. So in other words, the Obama administration believed that transgender students were protected by Title IX, and Title IX, signed by Richard Nixon into law, 1972, okay, prohibits sex discrimination in public education and any education that gets federal funds. All right. So now we have this guidance. It's a good thing. Great. So fast forward then to February of this year, 2017, just 3 weeks after Trump was sworn in as president, his Justice Department and his education departments issued a joint Dear Colleague letter, which was 1.5 pages long, and it rescinded the Obama Dear Colleague letter. And I'm going to read you just one little sentence out of the Trump Dear Colleague letter. The Department of Education and the Department of Justice have decided to withdraw and rescind the above-referenced guidance documents in order to further and more completely consider the legal issues involved. So that brings us to the lawsuit filed by Gavin Grimm and, people tend to forget this, his mother. Because he was a minor, his mother is the named plaintiff in this suit, and I think that's fabulous. So Gavin Grimm and his mom filed a lawsuit in Virginia because there was a bathroom law, and this was in 2014. So they go to the trial court to get an injunction to stop this law from being operational, and they lost. So then they appealed, and it went to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal, and the Fourth Circuit ruled in favor of Gavin and his mom. So then the state of Virginia said, okay, we're going to appeal it, and took it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Gavin's case was supposed to be argued this month before the U.S. Supreme Court, but it did not. And it did not because the U.S. Supreme Court decided they were no longer going to hear the case because of the Dear Colleague letter issued by the Trump administration. And in a one-sentence order, the U.S. Supreme Court sent the case back to the Fourth Circuit for them to consider their ruling in light of the new Dear Colleague letter. Okay, so that's the brief history. So, Rick, you have some information about North Carolina and what's happening with HB2.
Well, I have to kind of set the stage of why in the world the president of the Warriors would have any knowledge of this at all, right? So the NBA had awarded Charlotte the All-Star game that took place this last February. And as HB2 had come into play, at the owners' meeting we had in Las Vegas last July, this was on the agenda. Like, this was a source of great distress. You know, could we successfully execute our showcase event in Charlotte with the new law that was in place? So, you know, we have who I think is a terrific commissioner in Adam Silver, who I think has, in his very short tenure in that job, really demonstrated tremendous leadership. And Adam, you know, solicits viewpoints across all 30 of our teams, but he did reserve, you know, the last 10 minutes of that meeting and gave me the opportunity to talk to the other owners about how I personally felt about that and whether or not the NBA could go to Charlotte. And you know, that was a real gift for me to have the opportunity to speak to the 30 teams about my own experience and what it would mean to me that I couldn't go and that I was in contact with, you know, you owners don't even know. I'm in contact with people on your staffs, probably half your teams, of people who whose sexual orientation has not been out in their workplace and who don't feel comfortable sharing that yet at this point in time, and they're watching you. They're watching to see what you do, what statement you're going to make about the values of our league and what we stand for.
So you told all of them this?
The 30 owners. And the best thing that happened at the end of that is I got my first Michael Jordan hug. Michael is the owner of the Charlotte Hornets, and actually within our group is the business had the most to lose by us not doing that. And his team president, Fred Whitfield, African-American, awesome, worked so hard to try to get the state to really reverse. And we made the decision not to go to North Carolina. And that was followed... Even before we did that, many, many, many of the top musical acts in the country had decided they were not going to play Charlotte, they're not going to play in North Carolina. The NCAA stepped in right after. Mark Emmert, who I actually talked to yesterday, who runs the NCAA, who has chosen not to put any of the events they can put other competitions, tournaments, things like that, into North Carolina until there's some resolution here. So there is a... You know, I feel very proud of the sports community and how they've spoken about this. You know, the worst part of the law, at least as I understand it, I'll try to not trying to explain right to the ahead. Judge.
I'll correct you if you're wrong.
Is not what they even what they did at the state level. It's the fact that they prohibited local municipalities from passing their own laws that would be in conflict with what the state had done. So the state literally is dictating to the cities what their policy had to be here, and that's really the disconnect.
Yeah. So, and what's really sad, too, I mean, think about it, it was Charlotte that stepped up, the city council, and said, we are going to have laws that say there is no discrimination.
Right.
And because of what Charlotte did, then it gets slapped down by the state legislature, right. And now Charlotte suffers.
And suffers mightily. I can tell you that the whole state has suffered real economic distress because of this. And we all want to find a solution. So to really answer your question, so what's been going on over the last couple months have been the new governor has, I think, been working very diligently to try to find something that can get passed there to repeal HB2.
He's a Democrat.
He is a Democrat. They defeated the incumbent Republican who had been the primary advocate of this law. So it's been close and then not close and close and then not close. I do think, you know, I did hear this afternoon that there may be a bill that either tonight or tomorrow will get a vote that the NBA and the NCAA think, while not perfect, maybe a path back, because we would love to be able to go back to North Carolina. You know, in talking to the head of the NCAA yesterday, I mean, I think I shared my concern that this is one state, and of course, what's happened is people have seen this for their own reasons as being a politically advantageous position to take. And so we're seeing versions of other bathroom bills, you know, popping up in other states. And I guess that is a huge concern, right?
Yeah.
If this is now viewed as a way to further your political career to support something like this. So that we have to really watch and be vigilant about.
Right, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a bit. I think it's also important to know, I mean, when you talk about bathroom bills, you know, it's a sexy kind of thing, bathroom bills. But in HB2, and I say this for the reason that HB2 has three parts to it, and nobody's talking about the other two. So there's a part two of the bill that restricts minimum wage increases and child labor protections. And part three states that there is no longer, this is just amazing, there's no longer in North Carolina any state law claim for discrimination based on race, religion, color, national origin, age, sex, biological or otherwise, or handicap. There is no claim that can be made. So that's the third part, and I think it's important for people to know that there are these going on. Mia?
Yeah, so we saw a very similar thing happen in Houston. So I'm from Texas, from a small farming town where the biggest clubs in my school are Fellowship of Christian Athletes and Future Farmers of America. I was not in either of those clubs. And so growing up there in a farming town, I, as a trans kid, had a lot of problems in accessing the bathrooms. So there was no gender-neutral bathroom. The idea that I could just waltz into the girls' bathroom was a distant dream. So I would go 9-10 hours a day from when I got dropped off at school, 7:30, till I got home at 4:30 without going at all. Because when I went to the boys' room, I would be harassed, I would be assaulted, I would have people look over the stalls. And it caused a lot of medical problems for me, to the point where in actually elementary school, I had to have genital surgery to correct a urinary problem that got really bad because I was not going to the bathroom for that long. So this hits home for me and a lot of trans people who've had problems accessing the bathrooms. But we know that it's much bigger than that, and that it was never really about bathrooms. It was about whether trans people had the right to exist. Lauren Cox said so well that it's about do trans people have the right to exist in public? I would say it's, you know, do we have the right to exist at all? Because right. these people would like to deny that we're real. You know, you can touch me, I'm real. What happened in Houston was the Equal Rights Ordinance HERO covered all of those areas you just mentioned, disability, national origin, all of this. And it got turned into, this is a bathroom bill, when it wasn't. The whole bill was about no discrimination, and it mentioned bathrooms and public accommodations, which is also in Indiana. You know, the right that a store can say you can't buy something here because you're trans or you're queer is so obnoxious to me. And I love cake, but it's a lot bigger than that.
That's absolutely wow. So we know that bathroom, I'm going to continue to call them bathroom bills or laws, don't exclusively apply to educational institutions. But the fact is that it's high school kids that are bringing these lawsuits to try to change these laws. So Matt, San Francisco schools, California has AB 1266, it was a bill that amends the education code, and that was passed in 2013. And I'll just read from, this is the law in California. The education code requires that a pupil be permitted to participate in sex-segregated school programs and activities, including athletic teams and competitions, and use facilities consistent with his or her gender identity, irrespective of the gender listed on the pupil's records. That's the law in California. So, Matt, what is happening in the schools? We can talk San Francisco, and then if you can talk more generally about public schools and these bathroom bills.
Yeah, so, and thankfully that's the reality in California. And, you know, he wrote a dear colleague letter. I don't know if he considers us to be his colleagues or not. But if he gets the letter, that's not going to change what we're doing here. It's not going to change what's happening in San Francisco, which has been the reality. What you just read, which is the reality in California, has been the reality in San Francisco for decades. And it's been our approach here, not just when it comes to the question of a bathroom, but also how you're treated in our schools, how you're valued, how we see you. Whether you can be supported and live your identity in our schools. And I think what is at stake here is that when the federal government is sending the message to school districts all over the country and states all over the country that it's okay to be a bully, that it's okay to marginalize students and to violate their rights and their identities and stack up against them, I think we have a big problem, and you're going to have a lot of school districts and a lot of states who are going to take advantage of that. Right now, we have over 30 states that don't have any protections at all in their schools for students who may face discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, over half the states in the country. So it matters whether or not the federal government is on their side or up against them. So, you know, we're seeing already, and people are doing these studies, an increase in bullying, an increase in school districts rolling back some of these protections that they had put in place. So I think what we're going to need is we're all going to have to step up to take the side of a federal government that is now the enemy on this issue. We're going to have to step up and fight, because the reality is that kids who are already walking into school up against so much, their peers in some cases, their own school administrators, their school districts, their own state now have to deal with a federal government that is also not on their side.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So, Matt, you've brought up this whole issue of states' rights. And we all know states' rights has been frequently invoked to justify discrimination. I mean, look back at the Jim Crow laws. It was like states' rights, and we have a right to do what we want, and that enabled the southern states to maintain racial discrimination. States' rights argument was used to deny women the right to vote until we finally got the Constitution amended. And states' rights argument was used to fight against same-sex marriage. And more recently, Sean Spicer, justified revoking the transgender school guidance, this compliance letter, this Dear Colleague letter, by saying that President Trump is, and I quote, a firm believer in states' rights. So the question is, should the states be able to enact whatever laws they want? Now, we let the states decide how to handle voting. There is no one federal voting law. And yes, some states get it wrong, voter suppression, but then there's the courts that are there to rectify things. The federal courts stop the Trump's Muslim ban. So are states' rights a good thing or a bad thing when it comes to LGBTQ issues?
We want to defer to the judge on that question.
Oh. We were talking about one lawyer in the room.
So. Technically, I'm a lawyer, but
this is not so much a legal argument. It's a sense about should the states be able to do this and rely on the courts to make things right? And if not, then if you're saying, there should be one federal rule that governs all this, how does that happen? I mean, is that a constitutional amendment? We know what it takes to do that. So are states' rights a good thing on this? That California can do, the right thing here with the law that it has, and if Mississippi doesn't want to do it or Indiana, then the folks in those states are going to have to deal with it?
I'm not sure if that's the most productive question. I think it's a question that a lot of us are having. But LGBTQ people exist in every state and every county, and to leave it up to states and say, we understand things are a little bit different in Texas. Y'all can do whatever you want, burn the gays, kill the gays, whatevs, shouldn't be a conversation that we're having. So I think that the real conversation is, do LGBTQ people deserve the right to exist? Yes. Okay, so let's instill protections to make sure that we're not taken advantage of in our schools, in our homes, in our places of work. And yes, there should be a federal Equal Rights Act.
So, Mia, you don't see it just state by state. You see there should be just one overriding law, right?
Yes.
Okay. So in the 2017 legislative session this year, state legislators in 14 states have introduced bathroom bills. And real quickly, because some people are like, what states are doing? Alabama, Illinois, Kansas, Kentucky, Minnesota, Missouri, New York, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, Washington, and Wyoming. So it's happening.
Yeah.
These things are going on state by state. There is no one overriding. We have a Dear Colleague letter that basically says states go ahead and do this, right? And it's real interesting that on the states' rights issue, right? The Trump administration is really pushing states' rights, let the states do what they want. But they're not doing that, for example, on sanctuary cities. They're coming in trying to tell states what to do. Mm-hmm. So it's almost kind of whatever makes it easier to do what you want to do. Mm-hmm. So Is the sense here, is it just unanimous? Like there should be some sort of federal legislation? And if so, is that a pie in the sky? I mean, we can't even get an equal rights amendment that says women are equal to men. How are we going to get to LGBTQ equality?
But we have to work within the system we've been given, right? We can't just decide we want to change the way our country is governed. So, I think that, ultimately the courts are going to have to determine a lot of what you're asking, because there's going to be a conflict between federal and state views on this thing. So, I mean, Seattle just today, I just heard on the way over here, Seattle sued on the sanctuary city policy that was just announced by the federal government and withholding federal funds. So, I mean, I think, this is the way our system works. It's messy, right? It's not, there isn't going to be a simple solution that is going to be the be-all and end-all of this, and depends on where you start, like what your answer to the question is. I struggle with these questions just as our industry, because we are not a political organization, right? We have a very interesting role in our society where sports ends up being the place where a lot of these things are discussed, and actually where some of the most remarkable progress is made because of what we are. I mean, it's the ultimate level playing field in life, because it's really how good you are at what you do.
It's completely merit. It's merit-based.
It's merit-based. Right. And, but we didn't used to have black players in the NBA, right? And Chuck Cooper broke that barrier. And then, baseball, had the same issue. And, we celebrate Jackie Robinson for that. And Jaron Collins became the first active NBA player to come out as a gay man. So we get, because we're a safe space for people, it allows people who have nothing else in common to have a conversation about something they might be uncomfortable with. But I have to tell you, we weigh, I'm uncomfortable about answering some of these questions myself, because so many people in our country say, like, why are you even discussing this? Like, this is the one place in my life I don't have to think about this. I don't have to think about politics. I don't have to think about the problems I face every day, because I can find that sanctuary in sports. It's not that way. We have really smart athletes who are well-educated and have opinions, are allowed to have opinions about things other than, rebounds and block shots. We have coaches like ours who, has terrific standing when you want to talk about gun control, somebody whose father was assassinated in Beirut in a terrorist attack. I mean, if you have standing in that within an individual discussion in sports, I think we all commend it. What I struggle with a little bit with some of your questions, and why I'm not so jumping in, is we're not a political organization. I want somebody who supported Trump to buy a ticket to the Warriors game this Friday night, and I want them to feel welcome in that environment. Just the way when we first started the WNBA and we had our first meetings, it's like, oh my God, we have women kissing women at our games. What are we supposed to do about that? Well, if it's okay for one person to kiss another person at a basketball game, then we're not going to do anything about it, right? So it's a place where we can have these discussions, but we also want it to be a safe space for people who can not feel like they have to show their credentials before they walk into our arena to be okay to be one of our fans.
So, Mia, Matt, are you willing to just, wait the long haul? Because we know how long it took for, black folks to get our rights and, get the, anti-discrimination laws on the books. I mean, it took years and years and years, but we did it. So is that the sense? So if we want to, get something, an overriding law, we're just going to have to everybody bide our time?
No. I think we're here in San Francisco where we've never had that philosophy. We haven't had that philosophy when it's come to racial equality. We haven't had that philosophy when it comes to LGBT rights. And so I think if there are times when the local jurisdiction or state jurisdiction has to defy the federal government or has to say that actually we need to go further than what you're saying we're able to, we need to do that and we need to set that in motion. But at the same time, there needs to be some basic foundational rights that are protected for every single person in this country. And every person in this country is entitled to equal protection under the law. And our courts have to enforce that. Our federal government has to back that up.
And that's not the case now in some states, right?
And nobody, if they are under attack and they can't live their lives as who they are, that's a violation of our Constitution. And that's a violation under federal law. And actually, the interesting thing about the Dear Colleague letter, the reason why it wasn't actually a law that was overturned or an executive order, is because there already is a federal law. It's Title IX. Okay. And the question is actually the interpretation of the law, which is what is at stake here.
That's right.
Of whether it includes those protections. So we have Title IX for a reason, and it needs to be interpreted in a way that I think protects trans kids in our schools.
Yeah, and that is the danger, because with that second, the Dear Colleague letter that was just sent out, it raises the issue of whether or not the Trump administration is going to try to interpret Title IX, prohibition on discrimination based on sex, as not including gender identity. And that's an issue coming up, and it may very well, as we've all now said, end up in the courts. And the courts may be the great savior in all of this. We don't know.
There is a solution. It's called elections, right?
Okay.
We can look back at what happened last November and say, could that have been different, right? And we get to vote for our leaders, right? So to me, it's a call to action to say it's time to wake up. You know, it's time to actually use that right to express our opinions and actually have people govern.
I think that's what we're seeing. Yeah. I really do have a sense that that's really what is happening in this country. So let's talk a bit about remedies, because I mean, there's some positive things, like you've just mentioned, Rick, that are happening. And let's talk about economic boycotts. So three of the most effective boycotts ever that brought meaningful change were Martin Luther King Jr.'s bus boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, that ended segregation in the buses. Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers Union boycott of grape and lettuce growers that resulted in protections for farm workers. And the international economic boycott of South Africa that was critical to ending apartheid. So, Rick, we're back to you for a moment. The sports world has really seemed to be taking the lead on this. Can you tell us why you think that is, and then if you have anything more about what's happening in the boycott world, at least in sports?
Well, if that law does change in North Carolina, it's going to be because of the actions. I would say if you're going to weight it, actually the NCAA has been the most important influence in that, because of the importance of college sports in the state of North Carolina and the NCAA's absolute stance that it has to be consistent with the values of how student athletes are supposed to be treated, and there can't be an exception to that. Now, again, there's a difference. You know, they have member institutions who are operating there, right? So, you know, you might have noticed one might be in the Final Four. So, you know, they had, you know, in doing that, they're not saying we're not going to do business in that state. We have a school there. We have to do that. We have a franchise in the Charlotte Hornets who have to do business there. And, you know, it's actually with their blessing that we've taken the position that we have, even though it's causing tremendous hardship. They run their arena. It's not just getting an all-star game. It's all the concerts and all the performers who are not coming to North Carolina, who they depend upon to make their business work. And they have been great in saying we stand behind the values of the NBA. And I think it's going to work. I actually think it's going to work. And part of it's because of the ridiculously high visibility that sports has, and kind of an out-of-proportion importance it has based on its true economic value.
So that's a good thing.
It's definitely a powerful thing, right? It's a very powerful thing. So, you know, I'm very proud that our league, the NCAA, has said, you know, there is a line in the sand here, and we can't go someplace that's not consistent with our values, where we have a choice to do business.
Yeah, and some of the repercussions in North Carolina are really amazing. For example, the A&E Studios, Turner Broadcasting, and Lionsgate, they've just pulled all their planned future productions out of North Carolina. Raleigh, North Carolina, has lost nearly $9 million from canceled conventions. Greensboro, North Carolina, has lost $6 million from 8 conferences that were moved out of the state, and at least 13 conventions have been pulled out of poor Charlotte. As I said, you know, Charlotte was really doing the right thing. PayPal nixed a data center that would have employed at least 400 people with a payroll of about $20 million, pulled that out of North Carolina. And it just goes on and on. So economic boycotts, if you have the wherewithal to do that, tend to work. But my question to you all is that if you look, for example, at let me give you an example, Macy's. Macy's carries the Trump brand. And if, you know, you're concerned. That was Nordstrom's. But
well,
Macy's
does. Both of them are struggling.
So if you decided, you know, you wanted to try to get the message through on LGBTQ rights and issues, and you decide, okay, you know, boycott, Macy's, that's, you know, long term. I mean, and so the concern I have is, like, don't you lose the momentum and the motivation? I mean, how do you... How do you make that work? What are your thoughts about that?
So one of the biggest barriers for economic boycotts in the LGBTQ community is that we ain't got no money. particularly trans people are 4 times more likely in the U.S. to live on under $10,000 a year, which is far below the national poverty line. And so when you're talking about, so I heard, I took this economic class. There's this thing called discretionary income. I've heard that some of y'all have it. And so I know that there has been some limited success in the LGBT community on boycotting certain beers or companies, pastas, that are anti-gay. But for trans people, really getting your cis allies, including LGBT people, to boycott companies that support these policies can be really hard, especially if you're looking at it from a social justice intersecting lens, because PayPal, you mentioned, and other companies that might be great on trans issues could be horrible on racial justice issues. And they could be great on supporting refugees, but, you know, horrible for the environment. And so you have to pick and choose, you know, am I going to support LGBT rights or am I going to support the environment? And what... the question that I always ask is, what good is LGBT rights if our Earth isn't habitable in 100 years for humans? So... you know, racial justice, economic justice, environmental justice, these are all important. And I think agitating the status quo, educating the public, organizing, boycotting, these are all important. But we also have to build. We have to build our own support systems, and we have to build these infrastructures that are going to support our community, because I know we have a lot of friends in the business community. I'm a socialist. I was a Bernie delegate at the DNC. And I don't believe that the corporations are going to save us, because saving us and supporting us isn't necessarily their best interest. It's about the bottom line. And so I think boycotts can help, but we have to look at other strategies as well.
Right. I think it's...
Let me interrupt 1 second and just let folks know. In just a couple of minutes, we'll be taking your questions from the panelists. So start thinking about what you'd like to ask. And if you do have a question now, you can even start lining up right now at the microphone. And it's to the right near the door, right there, if you have a question. So please don't hesitate. Don't be shy.
I was going to say there's also value to having, in addition to having the stick, to having the carrot. So, you know, I think what you're going to see happen if North Carolina gets to a place where people like the NCAA and the NBA can go back there, we're going to rush back there to try to say thank you for doing the right thing. So I do think not only the idea of being able to have some economic influence, but also be able to say we can have some positive economic influence as well, is actually resonating in some of those states.
So I'm just curious, though, why, for example, Indiana, there hasn't been a big... boycott. I mean, Indiana has this terrible law on the books, and I haven't heard, you know, and so we have what?
There has been California and San Francisco and lots of other places signed on to boycotting that. But also, to state the obvious, Indiana isn't California and it's not New York. And so I think maybe it didn't get as much attention.
So there's also the issue of travel bans, right? Mm-hmm. And I was very interested to find out that the United Kingdom And there are five states and several cities that prohibit their employees to travel to North Carolina.
Yes.
Wow.
So, and if the ban is lifted, then that's fine. So so there's economic boycotts that take the form as well as travel bans.
We have that is in San Francisco, and our school employees can't travel to North Carolina or to Arizona, actually.
Is that right?
Still from, yeah.
So I see there's one person lining up, but I'm going to just put another question out to everybody first. Congressman John Lewis from Georgia described, and by the way, President Trump described him as talk, nothing, just all talk. And of course, he was one of those who led the march on the Edmund Pettus Bridge and was seriously injured in fighting for civil rights. So he, John Lewis called his civil rights work, he described it as, this is his words, making necessary trouble. So my question to you are, there's lots of voices out there representing a panoply of causes, all making necessary trouble. Women's rights, reproductive rights, income inequality, immigrants' rights, environmental rights, health care, and that's just for starters. And it's sort of what Mia was picking up on. How do we keep the LGBTQ voices in the mix? How do we ensure that our voices are heard and not lost in the fray? What do we do? So, something to think about. Maybe someone who's at the microphone might want to weigh in at some point. And I'll come back to you all on that. I mean, how do we elevate this and keep it out there, right, when there's so much else going on? So why don't we go to questions, if you want to step up and you want to maybe tell us your first name, maybe? And,
yes, okay. So my name is Sluis, and I'm here from Twitter. So my question is this. We've all talked about a lot about how we think here in San Francisco. And I think here in San Francisco, we live in a little bit of a bubble. I'm from California as well. I'm from Turlock, if any of you know where that is. Yeah?
Big applause for Turlock.
And life is very different in Turlock. We're a very conservative town. And so my question is this. We are really polarized as a country right now. And so we have two options, either to really hold strong to our values and to continue to be polarized or to reach across the aisle and find the commonalities and advance our nation. What would your approach be in terms of healing and finding solutions to come together? And I'll give you a good example. My family, my mom is a Trump supporter. And I went and I asked her, how can you support Trump? Your son is gay. You know he stands for all these anti-LGBTQ issues. You know who Mike Pence is. And what do you think her answer was?
I don't agree with him on that, but I agree with him on other things.
There was something about Trump that really got to her, that she really supported. And so the fact of the reality is that we live in a world where Trump won, and there's a reason why he won. And so how do we begin to understand the other side? How do we begin to find commonality with the other side and not label them as homophobes, as anti-LGBT, as racist? How do we begin to make bridges instead of burning them?
I do want to take one issue with you. You said he won. Yes, he won. He did not get the majority of the votes that were passed.
And that's my second question. I have two questions,
that's
actually.
That's all the Electoral College. That's a whole other discussion. So the healing. How do we get stuff done here and still hold true to our values? Anybody want to jump in?
My whole family... Oh, sorry. I broke my arm. We'll talk about that later. if anyone wants to ask a question about the trans broken arm syndrome. Both of my parents, my whole family basically voted for Trump, and I've tried to have conversations with them instead of asking some very pointed questions I would love to ask. Going back to those values, those Christian values that I grew up with, and saying, you know, how is this showing love? How is this showing compassion? How is this building a community that you want your Texas to look like? Do you want Texas to be ripping families apart? Do you want them putting all of the gays in mental institutions? Hopefully not. And trying to find those commonalities and bridging it that way.
Mia, so what answers did you get, though, when you asked those questions?
I mean, I similarly got, well, he's not really racist, or he's not really anti-gay. He holds up a LGBT flag. But I think, you know, trying to show the impact now that he has been in office a couple of months has been more beneficial, because I think a lot of those Trump voters are seeing what we were talking about before the election.
I think, you know, we those in our community have an obligation just to be our authentic selves, right? I think it's an incredibly powerful thing. I think, you know, we're a lot less scary when people know us.
Do you mean more people should come out?
At that point in time when they're ready to, because there's so many powerful voices, unexpected voices out there that could be harnessed here to have this discussion. The other thing, I don't have the answer to your question, but to really circle my age, I still read the New York Times every day. Okay. I read it online.
In paper? So,
I read it online.
The paper.
I do read it online. Okay. They're doing the greatest thing this week to try to nick at that problem, because they're collecting the best opinion pieces from the left, from the right, and from the middle. And I have found it fascinating reading this week that they're actually, the New York Times is saying, here's some really thoughtful stories from the right. And I'm reading these stories saying, I got to go back and check. Was that left or right? Maybe those are really, that's an interesting idea that I hadn't really looked at that way. And, you know, my mother was a, bless her soul, was a, you know, she would not watch anything but Fox News. That defined the world, and our media world has gotten so fragmented. We can isolate ourselves with people who only have those opinions. And you know, the media is so fragmented today that not enough of us are willing to have the intellectual confidence to explore opinions outside of ours. And until we are, boy, I don't know how we do it.
Okay, let me take another question. Right ahead.
My name's Jennifer, and I work at Our Family Coalition, and I wanted to give a quick response to that last item. After Prop 8, I think that our community learned a lot about how to actually change hearts and minds, and I know that my agency was part of something called the Breakthrough Conversations Project that trained people to go out and have those one-on-one conversations, and I think that's how we're going to get minds to be changed, hearts and minds to be changed, rather than just polarizing further. Mm-hmm. I also just wanted to quickly give props to this SFUSD, having two kids who've been there since kindergarten and are now in 10th grade. Mm-hmm. They only know gender neutral bathrooms. They don't see it as any big deal. And the letters to parents and families that have come from the school district in the face of different things coming out of D.C. have been so moving and so right on target. I'm really, really impressed. And I'm just honored that that's where my kids are being raised.
Thank you.
My actual question is to Rick
Welts. I'll pay you later.
Rick Welts, I would just like to hear a little bit about what it's like as a gay man to raise kids in today's political world.
This is new to me. So in the last 6 years, right? I inherited a now a 16-year-old girl and a almost 13-year-old boy. And it's, you know, it's been, I've got a bunch of my coworkers sitting here in the front row who somehow have decided to sit here and listen to this instead of watching the San Antonio Warriors game right now. Hopefully, I don't want a score update. It might ruin my evening.
He's checking the score right
now. Yeah, there we go. So it's just been an exhilarating experience for me personally to have that part of my life that I never thought I was really going to have. And I will also say that in our world, which, you know, still trails the rest of society, it has been the most welcoming environment. You know, I came out on the front page of the New York Times in 2011 and had no idea what to expect, right? And it's turned out to be just an amazing embrace from the people, not only that I work with every day, but from our industry in a very unexpected way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the experience has been remarkable, and the experience now, I have utmost respect for all of you who are parents. I got in this game late, and you know, it's the most important and hardest thing anybody will ever do.
Next question.
Thank you all for being here. My name is William Walker. I grew up here in San Francisco, and a young African-American gay male. And I like to think I'm normal. I mean, I have a couple privileges. I have the privilege of serving on the board for San Francisco LGBT Pride Celebration, and really happy that we could be here and be a part of this.
Thank you.
I work at UC Berkeley. And student services, and I also used to work at the school district, so props to Matt. And me and Mia are delegates for the Democratic Party, so we're very multifaceted, the San Franciscans. One of the problems that I'm facing, just working with students and working with communities of color, working with the LGBT community, and actually just working with our world as a whole, is issues around acceptance and tolerance in the LGBT community. I was walking down the street with my partner the other day and got this side comment about how, wow, I really wish I could be a fly on the wall with you. And I think it was because it was an untraditional couple in his eyes, because my partner's not the same race as I. And I attended a town hall meeting one of my first few weeks. I just started at UC Berkeley, and a student, a young Latino queer man of color, spoke about how he didn't feel comfortable talking to his lecturers in his section, his discussion section, because he had he wanted to talk about queer influences in regard to his major. And I want to, you know, give that student protection, so I'm not going to say what his major is, but didn't feel that his instructors were able to support his ideas of what queer identity were in his professional career.
Can you give us your question?
So my question is, pardon me, how can we look at issues around acceptance and tolerance and making sure that we're nurturing our own in our community? Because we're being asked to extend olive branches, but there's still a lot of division within acceptance within different communities of color and different LGBT, the different letters of our alphabet soup of our community.
Any responses here? Anybody want to jump in?
So, I mean, I think we have to look within ourselves before we can teach and help others, and that there's a lot of unchecked racism, classism, ableism within the LGBT community, and that we need to, you know, so I worked with young people for like 5 years doing cultural humility, cultural competency trainings. And one of the most helpful exercises, I think, you know, you mentioned I have a couple privileges. You know, I'm a gay black man, but I also have privileges. Some people, their mind is like, what? I don't understand. But I think like we can kind of get that, but to go through, and check, like, do some sort of matrix. I can help you, go to MiaTooMuch.com, to do an assessment around what privileges do I have and how can I leverage those privileges to help others. And so I think that's what it's all about.
We have time for one more question. Go ahead. Thank you, Mia.
I'll be really quick. I'm Michelle, and thank you so much for everyone who's here and those who are participating on the panel. It's interesting, you know, the question of this forum, which is not my question, what's at stake? It was really easy for me to answer. What's at stake is what's at stake for a lot of Americans, you know, access to healthcare, access to education, just basic rights. When I look at LGBTQ history and I think of leadership, I think of Harvey Milk, who once said that in order for us to get some of these basic access and rights, we've got to come out. So there was an era in our history in which, you know, a leader in our community told us to come out. Well, we're out. So in a time in which access to those basic rights are still being questioned, if not erased, if we're listening to the forum today, I mean, being erased from the census is just plain frickin' mean. It just means that we're invisible now, that we don't exist, and that's wrong. I ask all three of you who have been chosen for this panel because you exist as a leader in your community to some degree, You know, what is it that we do? What is it that leaders should be exhibiting? I mean, Rick, you are part of the NBA. You're part of multi, I think it's probably billions. I'm not a sports person. Industry, it is billions. You know, being out, is that enough? Or what are you doing as a leader in your industry, you know, to break those grounds? And I hear boycotting, but, you know, also for Matt, being a part of the school board, you know, what does that mean, being out and a leader? Mia, being a transgender activist, getting into politics, being out obviously isn't enough because at this point we're being erased.
Let's take your quick responses really quick, all right?
So I'll answer at stake because I didn't actually answer that. Our lives are at stake and trans women of color lives are at stake. Over 9 trans women of color have been murdered this year alone. Last year, 23 had been murdered. And so if we keep up with this rate, we'll have 36 murdered by the end of the year. And they represent less than 1 in 1,000 in the population, but represent over 72% of the LGBTQ hate crimes. And so as a community, we need to step up and support our sisters.
Okay. Matt?
You know, I think that we have a responsibility, especially here locally, to build the sort of communities that we think are possible. So at a time when the federal government is going in one direction, we have to go that much quicker in the other direction. And, you know, San Francisco has always had that responsibility, but it's still really hard to be a kid in this city growing up here. And if we can create a reality where they really have the opportunities that they should, where they can benefit from everything that's happening here, I think that's how we resist Trump and Trumpism, is actually building the sort of realities and futures that we know are possible.
And Rick?
You know, I would just not underestimate what each one of us can do individually using our voices. You can be on a panel. Like this whole group in the front row, we just came from a screening this afternoon of a Comcast documentary called Tomboy, which is about a discussion of gender in sports and the challenges that women face that men don't face in sports. You know, that's our whole staff just did that. I'm on the NBA's Global Diversity and Inclusion Committee. We're making this, you know, a priority of the league. We're counting. We're reporting statistics. You know, I'm just now. There's a movement by the woman who owned the Pulse nightclub in Orlando to make that a national monument, and I think I'm going to join that effort to do that. We have a voice. I think all those pale in comparison to our willingness to mentor. You know, there's a lot of people who need some strength to live their authentic life. And, you know, those of us who didn't have those people and wished we had now have an opportunity to be those people for others and to use our voices and use our experience to give confidence and standing to people who may not feel they have it.
Well, thank you. That was our final audience question. So it is an in-forum tradition to ask all of our panelists the following question, and I'm going to ask this of each of you. What is your 60-second idea to change the world? Who wants to go first?
No pressure.
I'll be quick. Let's do the, you know, live up to our Pledge of Allegiance, liberty and justice for all. Okay. And then selfishly, I would say, because I still have 60 seconds, I want something that we all can take to remain at the age we are forever. So Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson can play for the Warriors forever.
Good.
All right.
Good.
Okay, so yeah.
Wow. I want that idea. That's a good one. You know, sitting next to, I thought about this beforehand, sitting next to Rick, one of the things that I think could really change the world is if we paid our teachers like we do our NBA stars.
Hell yes.
You know, I think that alone, and I hope that wouldn't make things difficult for you and we can still win. I'm not saying that NBA stars have to get paid like teachers necessarily, but I think that would really make a huge impact on our world.
Mia?
I didn't practice this question, but I think that a revolutionary idea that shouldn't be is universal health care, and that we should be moving forward
That's
a lot faster than we are. So Medicare for all, follow the hashtag, follow the legislation, and let's get it in California and get it in the United States.
Great. Thank you. So I'm just going to break tradition and give my 60-second idea to change the world, and it's actually only three words. Make necessary trouble. Yes. So let's give a big thank you and a round of applause to our panelists this evening, Matt Haney, Commissioner, San Francisco Unified School Board, Mia Satya, community organizer, social justice advocate, and 2016 San Francisco Pride Grand Marshal, and Rick Welts, President and Chief Operating Officer of the Golden State Warriors. And thank you all for joining us for tonight's conversation here at InForum at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you.